Welcome to another one of our monthly audios. This is Gary Staubel, back with you as always with another audio interview. And this month I'm back with John Magruder for part two of our conversation about his work, about finding talented recruiters to work for your firm, and also just how he runs his business as well. And as a recap, I mentioned this on the first interview, but John is the managing partner of R2R Search. He recruits high-level recruiters for boutique headhunting firms. John himself has been in the business for about 20 years. He's based in Boise, Idaho, and you can find his company at r2rsearch.com. So it's R, the number two, rsearch.com. And I came into contact with John, I believe, for the first time through one of my interview guests who had some very good things to say about him and the service. And I think someone who is recruiting top-level headhunters is a bird's-eye view into a lot of topics that that you're going to find interesting as a listener. So, John, thanks so much for coming back and sharing this morning with us.
You bet. My pleasure.
So when we left off on the first conversation, we were talking about hiring top recruiters. And I just wanted to ask you a few more questions around that and then maybe switch and talk a little bit about time management and some other issues.
Okay.
In terms of timing, we're recording this in 2021. This is probably an obvious question, but how do you feel about scaling up at this time for owners? Do you think they should have that front and center? Or what's your feeling on that?
Well, I definitely do. I think, again, we touched on it last time, but you know, a lot of really smart people in this world that I get a chance to talk to and that are in this industry believe that we're on a cycle that should last years. So if you're bringing in top talent now, then you should hopefully be able to reap those rewards for several years. As we see the market, I think in a place I've never seen it before, my 20 plus years in this business, as far as the demand for search and recruitment services, I think it's going to be across most sectors and verticals and industry specialties. It's going to be as hot as it's ever been.
Mm-hmm. And so with regard to that, what do you think are some of the mistakes that owners make when they're trying to find or hire recruiters?
Well, it's an interesting question because I often refer to our industry as I do say this tongue in cheek, but kind of an industry full of hypocrites. What I mean by that is that we don't do as we say when we're recruiting for our clients. So let me give you an example. So I've got a firm that had me retained since about March, and it's been a challenging search. And I'll go back to something we talked about last time. It's an individual contributor role, which again is a very, very, very challenging role to fill right now. And so I presented a candidate that was actually very good, and he emailed me back probably within 15 minutes of seeing my write-up and said, yeah, let's set it up. But unfortunately, his calendar was booked out for like 10 days. So he came back and said, let's set it up for, you know, a week from Friday. And I was already shaking my head when I read it. But I mean, what am I going to do, right? It's the firm owner. He likes to take the first step. So that was the first time that he had, I guess, available. And the Thursday before the interview, the candidate called me and said, hey, I got a job offer. I'm accepting. So please cancel the interview. So you know, timeliness, you got to follow your own advice. Time kills all deals. I think we've all heard that one in this industry before. So, you know, being timely, being efficient, even if you have a multi-step process, you know, try and get the candidates through each step in a timely fashion. Don't let too much time go in between conversations or meetings because it really is a competitive market. And if you're not out there moving quickly and aren't able to be nimble, then, you know, your competitor is probably going to get the edge on you and maybe take somebody off the market before you even get a shot. So that's one thing for sure that I see people do is they, you know, I don't know. It's a hard conversation for me to have because I don't want to feel like I'm pushing them out of a comfortable place, but I do try to, with each correspondence, try to remind them that they are interviewing other places and that we better move quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's tough because it's your job to let them know that on the one hand, but it's also can be perceived that you're rushing things or you're pushing them faster than they want to go. So it's a bit of a dance. I think as a pre-close, before you even submit a candidate, if you can have that conversation because probably a lot of owners are not really aware that the candidate short marketplace also applies to recruiters. You know, they're probably thinking about whoever they recruit as who that applies to, but not really realizing it also applies to people they want to recruit themselves for their company, you know?
Right.
So
I do try to remind them as frequently as possible, but it's just interesting to see it happen so much, you know, in our industry. But it's definitely an education that needs to continue to happen on a daily basis.
So dragging their feet or not realizing the speed at which this needs to move, any other mistakes they make, just whether it's conceptual or expectations or anything like that that you see?
Well, I mean, certainly on a case-by-case basis, I see some things that make me scratch my head with, you know, regards to a lot of the clients I work with do have a very high bar, which they should. I mean, you know, we're going after the top 5-10 percenters in our industry when they're using me. So, I mean, you should have a high bar, but sometimes it gets to the point of ridiculousness. I mean, you know, I've had people pass on candidates because of a nervous tick in an interview. And the guy's, you know, 750K biller, and sometimes he twirls the hair in his beard, and that was enough to reason to pass on a candidate. I mean, you know, there's just some funny, quirky things that, you know, you run into out there. But, you know, it also brings up a good point. You know, when I run into companies that seem to have a little bit of a unrealistic expectation, it's a beautiful thing about what we do. It's why I don't work in-house. I like to be on the agency side. I get to pick and choose who I recruit for. So, you know, a lot of times if you get into a situation where things are moving too slow or they have some very unrealistic expectations, then, you know, you get through that search, you move on, and you just don't work with them. And I have definitely, you know, found some very good firms that don't like the way my style. And likewise, I've found firms that enjoy working with me, but I'm not interested in continuing to work with them for that purpose either. So for the most part, though, if I reverse the question a little bit to talk about those that are having success, you know, there's a lot of creative thinkers out there, and they try to, I love this saying, I don't know if I said it last time to you or not, but rather than having a box that you're trying to find somebody to fit into, build the box around a really good, talented person. And those are the firms that I believe are having the most success right now, not only hiring, but retaining their top people.
Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? Build the box around the person. What does that mean to you?
Well, it can mean a lot of different things. I mean, some people are very anti-metric KPI driven. And even if you have a bit of a metric or a KPI process that you like everybody to hire, you know, if you want to make a run at that person, you're going to have to give them probably more freedom than you would somebody else. Some firm owners can do that. Some can't. You know, it could be allowing somebody to work remote or allowing somebody to work a flexible work schedule. It could be working out a pattern to help somebody with, you know, there are people out there that are really good, but they are just anti-draw. They do not want the draw. It's terrifying to them. But they're still motivated. They're still hardworking. They've still got a great pedigree. And so, you know, I've got firms that'll be like, fine, you know what, we'll come up with a plan that makes sense. And they do. Mm-hmm. It's not complicated. And if any of your, you know, listeners want to talk to me, I'm happy to kind of give them the secret sauce there. But it's really, there's more than one way to get to the end result. And so, you know, by charging a lower commission schedule on the first 100K or 150K in production, and then bumping it back up to where a more traditional draw would be to help you recoup, you know, your expense of the salary. You know, but there are a lot of firms out there that if they're a draw shop, it's a hard no. It's a hard no. I've had firms that I know, because they stated it to me multiple times, I will not go beyond $100,000 draw. And when the firm down the street that I work with is happy to give somebody $120,000 or $125,000 draw, like, I don't even send the talent to them. So then we're talking about, again, top 5-10 percenters in our industry. So it's always interesting to me when I talk to firms that have a hard line in the sand with regards to anything, whether it be how the comp is structured, the work flexibility, the KPIs and the metrics. It's just, you know, the firms right now that I'm having the most success with, that I'm watching hire some really, really good people, are flexible, and they're able to customize the program for the individual so that it feels good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. That makes sense. And I'm just thinking about the draw issue. Well, here's a question. What percent of your clients use a draw versus a salary? Forget everything else that, you know, commission structure or whatever. I'm just curious, draw versus salary, what percent would you say?
So a lot of the, you know, the fully retained shops that I work with do a salary. Mm-hmm. A lot of the hybrid shops that are maybe a, you know, mixture of retained, contingent engagement, and then maybe just, you know, straight up contingent, a lot of times they're the draw shops. Very mm-hmm. rarely do I have that sort of a structure. Mm-hmm. And then when you get into the staffing model where it's a split desk, it's almost always a base salary in those scenarios. I think the one exception that I've seen is that the firms that are from the UK that are launching in the US, I mean, the model in the UK is to pay a base salary, even on a 360 contingent desk. Whereas in the US, most of the firms that come out of, you know, the United States base, then those are traditionally a draw shop.
Hmm. So they'll do potentially a 100K draw, but it's still a draw, even if it's a higher number.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's different categories of firms that I see out there. You know, some obviously want to keep the draw as small as possible, or maybe they'll do a bigger draw for the first 6 months and then they'll back it down, you know, once that person's got a little momentum behind them, because obviously, mm-hmm. you know, you traditionally make the most of your money off of the production side of it. So, you know, there's a lot of models out there, but I typically see firms that prefer that 50 to 70K draw, and they really get uncomfortable if you ask them to go much higher than that. Mm-hmm. And then I have firms that, like I said, maybe six figures is the magic number that they try not to cross. And then mm-hmm. I think about some of the firms that I'm working with today that I've had the most success with, and they just say to me and to the candidate, as long as it pencils out, I'm willing to have a discussion, right? I mean, that I had a firm, they just hired somebody last week. I think I was referencing that we placed somebody on a practice leader role. And, you know, they went someplace with that draw that I've never seen before from them. I mean, it was, you know, 250K draw. I think that's my biggest that I've done so far.
Wow.
Now, I've had lots of companies do first year guarantees that exceed that. But as far as just a straight up draw at 250, that was the number that was needed. But when you have a $1.2 to $1.5 million biller that you think with your tools can become a $2 million biller, that draw doesn't seem too bad. And that's what they felt like.
Mm-hmm. So, wow, 250K draw. I have not heard of that either. And that was for a $1 million producer. Okay. And I think you said something before that I wanted to ask you about, but I spaced out on it. But in regards to these different pay models, so you said it would be, they might do I wish I wrote that down. You said it might be for the first 6 months or something, there's a higher draw and then it backs down. What would that look like as an example?
Oh, I mean, you know, I have a firm that, you know, their preference is to basically offer the minimum draw possible, because legally, you know, for most states, it's going to be somewhere between 35 and 45,000 would be sort of your minimum legally that you're allowed to, unless you 1099 them, you have to, you know, give them some sort of draw equivalent to what minimum wage in your state would be times 2080 or, you know, a full-time job. So, you know, let's just use 35,000 as the example. If they're hiring somebody away from another firm where they've got, you know, some commissions already coming in and their biweekly check looks much stronger than that, they might give them 7 or 8,000 in non-recoverable draw on the first, you know, 6, 9, 12 months. And then at some point, let's, you know, pull it back to that 35,000. But hopefully at that point, you know, there's so much momentum with placements and cash in and receivables that, you know, the draw is an afterthought anyway. So that's just a model. Now, again, I don't have as much luck selling that to top tier producers. But I have made placements with companies that's the plan, and I've had candidates accept that as the plan. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but those are some ways to do it. A lot of the firms that I'm working with right now, if they are on a non-recoverable draw structure, is they'll guarantee the first 90 days like a salary. So, you know, because again, you know, you're not going to probably make a placement. You're certainly not going to have any cash in that first month. So it's all likely that, you know, your cash in will start in that third or fourth month, even if you get off to a good start. By the time somebody gives notice, gets started, the invoice is paid 30 days after they start, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, what you'll see is they'll give them that first 90 days, treat it like a salary, and then the draw goes live in the fourth month.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. Any other structures? I mean, I wrote those down, but anything else that comes to mind as a creative structure for setting these?
No, I mean, I touched on it earlier. You know, I've got several firms that, you know, if somebody's just really anti-draw, they'll do a guaranteed base. They'll just reduce the commission percentage on the first bit of production to sort of offset that cost. It's not a complicated model. It really isn't. And I'm surprised more firms aren't more adaptive to it, because you know, a good recruiter is hard to come by. And just because somebody feels more comfortable with a 70K base than they do a 70K draw, shouldn't mean that you just necessarily say, no, I don't want to talk to them. So, you know, it's not, you just use a different commission schedule in the beginning. And so basically you've recaptured your 70K, and then you throw them right back into your 45, 50, 55, 60% commission model and let them run like the wind.
Okay. And since you brought up commission, any thoughts or advice on commission structure in terms of how much? You mentioned 45 or whatever. If it was a straight draw, what do you see as far as typical commission?
If it's a straight draw, I would say that I don't think I work with anybody that doesn't start at least 40%. I think that's sort of the minimum. I think I may have bumped into some that start in the 30, 35% range, but I've never successfully placed anybody with that kind of a structure. So that might tell you a little bit more about how I feel about that commission structure. But, but yeah, I would say on most draw shops that I'm working with or that I'm pulling out of, the commissions will start no less than 40% and then generally tier up to at least 50%, if not higher. I think the most aggressive that I've seen would be, I think 60% is about the most that I've seen, but I have seen, again, I've got some clients that can get very creative, and, you know, they've put special tiers in there for some top producers. I mean, I like one firm in particular that's coming to mind, they hired somebody that was traditionally in that $1.5 million to $2 million a year range. And so for them, once they got to a million, they were willing to part ways with 65%. Because it made their top producer happy, because that's what he wanted in that particular scenario. And they had already made, you know, approximately half of the first million in the way of profit. And so, I mean, for them to say, hey, you know what, I'm perfectly happy with 35% for anything above a million, and you keep 65. And so, again, that's some of the things you have to get creative. I think we're going to talk a little bit about retention down the road here, but those are things that are important to do for your top billers, is to make sure that you're giving them a very competitive pay plan. Because let me tell you something, a lot of firms are thinking about making some adjustments to try and pull people away. And I certainly know which shops are traditionally going to be on the lower side of that commission schedule. And if I go take a plan that's, you know, 10 to 15% better to somebody that's producing at a high level, I mean, we're talking about $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 more in their pocket. That's enough sometimes to get passive talent to say, hey, I'll take that call.
Yeah, that makes sense. How about once they are hired? So if somebody hires a recruiter, maybe somebody from you, what are the, I guess, the good and the bad things that you would suggest there in terms of onboarding and training, integrating someone? We'll start with the, you know, the mistakes, I guess. What are there any obvious mistakes that firms make when they bring someone on board?
Well, not the firms that I work with, because I probably wouldn't keep working with them if they were traditionally had a poor onboarding process. And I'll also give you this caveat. Almost every placement I've made in the last, well, since COVID, has been a virtual role. I can count on one hand the number of placements that I've made since COVID where it was going to be in an office environment. So the vast majority of the time when I'm placing people, they're 100% work remote. And the reason I wanted to start with that is because I think onboarding remote workforce is very different than trying to onboard somebody that's going to be in the office with you every day. So I'll just give you that additional color as I answer that question, because I'm referring to people that are going to be working from home versus working in an office. So if I'm thinking about firms that have success onboarding, first of all, you know, if there's anything more than 2 weeks of I accept the job to I start, you should definitely have some sort of a drip campaign in place to stay in touch with that person. Because again, it is an aggressive competitive market. And if you're not staying in front of them and staying warm, then they feel just a little bit of lack of love in their life, then they could easily become victim to somebody else swooping in and taking them from you. So I definitely recommend that I do this too on behalf of my firms, and then we kind of tag team and do it together. But you know, it's not uncommon to have an extended start date, especially this time of year, because a lot of people have bonuses coming up for year-end production. And if they've already qualified for that, you know, you may be looking at a start date in January or February of people that you're hiring today. And so you definitely want to have some sort of a, you know, you can kind of mix it up, but you can have like a text, you can have an email, you can have a phone call, you can have a Zoom, you can, you know, mix it up and do different things to try and keep in front of that person. And then once they're started, I would say the biggest thing is, especially in a virtual workforce, you know, you got to get them introduced to the team. You got to make them feel like they're part of the group. I actually just attended one this morning where I just happened to have two placements that started, you know, with a firm. And this is a firm that I've placed a bunch of people with. So they, you know, I get invited to be on some of these video calls sometimes, especially when we're bringing new people on. But, you know, they did a really good job of going around the room virtually and having everybody introduce themselves and give some little personal nugget. And so it wasn't all work related. You know, a lot of people talked about they talked about playing sports in college and just different things like that. So it was a really fun, and I was watching the body language of the two people that started, and I could tell that they were engaged. I could tell that they were smiling a lot. You know, there was a lot of times to laugh and they were laughing, and just, it felt good. And then, so, you know, I think I can morph this question into retention, because from an ongoing standpoint, that's important for that firm. You know, they're probably a 30-person boutique, and they've got people in probably 10 different states. And so, you know, at least once a week, they try to get everybody on a call, a video call, where you can see faces and have some fun and enjoy each other. And then, you know, obviously, you got to talk shop too. But, you know, I just think that those things are super important. And I'll tell you, I think sometimes we underestimate the importance of just making sure they have every piece of equipment prior to their day of that they start. So if you've got a dual monitor, docking station, laptop, you know, mouse and keyboard, and maybe a phone or whatever the structure is, it's like, make sure that's there. And this, and during these times where we have difficulty knowing, you know, from a transportation standpoint, you know, I think logistics is creating a lot of delays in delivery. So you got to really start thinking ahead from the moment that they say, yes, I want to start, about what's your home address, you know, let's get you set up with your home office stuff. And you know, those are the things that it sounds simple, but I mean, I've seen many people start, they don't have their laptop, you know, and then it's like, well, they can use their personal one, but it just doesn't feel good. Right. I mean, it just doesn't have quite as much pop to it. I mean, some firm, I had one firm that hired a woman and they sent her a nice bouquet of flowers. And I think they got there like the weekend before her start date, but they just telling her how excited they were to have her be a part of the team. You know, I've had people send swag, you know, it could be t-shirts, squishy balls, anything like that. But just those little connection points, I think, go a long way. And then, you know, just the obvious stuff then, it's just, you know, staying in touch, making sure that all their questions are answered. If there's any concerns that they can, you know, let's address them. Let's be proactive. Tell me what doesn't feel good. You know, it's just like we do with candidates, right? I mean, sometimes a recruiter is nervous to ask, you know, what red flags do you have? But you should always ask that question because, you know, if you don't ask it, they may not volunteer it. But if you do ask and there's something on their mind, traditionally they'll open up and give you a little more information if something doesn't feel good. But I think it's just being, you know, being aware of the individual, especially if they're not sitting in front of you or next to you, is just to ask the questions. It's like, okay, what didn't feel good today, or what did feel good today? And then let's talk about ways to have more of the feel good and less of the don't feel good.
And two questions popped into my mind. One is, and I'm going to ask them both so I don't forget, and then you can take them in whatever order. But the first one is, how many people are getting hired without meeting in person at all? And then the second one is, Oh God, Gary, I think I just forgot the second one. So why don't you take a stab at the first one and the other one will
Okay.
come back, I'm sure.
All right, no problem. I would guess right now it's probably 75-25. So 75% of the time there's no physical meeting. It's all video calls and phone calls and that kind of stuff. And I think again, you know, it's becoming so commonplace that we run our desks that way that I think that it's just been accepted. But I will say a lot of those firms, I would say every single firm in the 75% column of, you know, happy to hire you without meeting you would meet the candidate if the candidate felt better about meeting in person first. So it's not a requirement. But if I ever have a candidate say, hey, you know, like, when can I meet everybody? And you know, again, part of the recruiting process is to source for that. Right. So I'm like, okay, so you want to meet them in person. And then I just go to the client and I'm like, hey, we've got somebody that wants to fly in and shake hands and actually see the people they're going to be working with. And then we just make it a pretty seamless process. We don't even act surprised, you know, we're just like, oh, okay, sure. Yeah. Let's get that scheduled. And so, but I would say 25% still are very much of the mindset that if I can't meet them, I can't hire them. And so they'll fly them in. And I haven't really ran into any issues with people saying, no, I don't want to travel. So most of the time the candidates are willing, well, all the time, I guess, because I haven't had any that didn't, are willing to fly in if that's a requirement. So again, I think the biggest thing that I would say to that though, is if you're going to fly them in, like, bite the bullet, pay the expensive ticket and get them down there inside of a week. If you start playing the 2 weeks and 3 weeks game, I don't care how much interest there was in the beginning, it wanes. You allow other competition to come in there and start introducing themselves. Things happen. And so, you know, if you're going to make the flying to meet in person requirement, it's fine. I'm not telling you, I'm not even suggesting that you don't do it, but do it quickly so that you don't run the risk of losing the momentum.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because sometimes the small things are the big things. You know, when you think about if somebody gets hired and in one scenario, the owner does send a large bouquet of flowers, let's say, as a welcome, the next day it arrives after they accept. You know, that happens. They are in touch with them, like you send. They send a box with some swag and some company t-shirts or anything like that. That's not a lot of work for the owner, but the impression that would make in terms of making someone feel welcome can make a huge difference, you know?
Yeah. I that's my whole point, actually. You said it much more eloquently than I did, but yes.
Okay.
It is absolutely the little things that can make the biggest differences. And, you know, if you're it's scary, even for, you know, us. I mean, I noticed on LinkedIn, you and I are about the same age. I mean, if we were in a situation where we were making a job change, it's still nerve-wracking. It's still, there's uncertainty. Yeah. You know, you just can't help it. And those little things can help soften that up and create a lot of excitement. You know, I still send the happy first day, you know, text to every single candidate I place. It's not a big thing, right? It doesn't require a lot of my time, but I try to write a nice personal note that says, hey, I just wanted to wish you good luck on your new adventure. And, you know, and let me know if there's anything I can do for you. And please keep me in mind for referrals and, you know, that kind of stuff. Right. And those things always pay off in a positive way. A lot of times I'll touch base with them at that 30 or 60 day mark as well. I think a lot of recruiters get really nervous about doing that because they're afraid to hear something that they don't want to hear. But guess what? If they're experiencing something that you don't want to hear, they're experiencing it whether you reach out to them or not.
Right. You can either know about it or not know about it. Yeah.
There's been a number of times that I've been able to save deals because, you know, of something that took place that didn't feel great, but they weren't ever – they didn't get asked, so they never shared. And as being a third party, I was getting some honest feedback. And then I do a little coaching with the candidate to say, can I please talk to the leadership so that I can let them know, especially if I feel like it's justified. I mean, if the person's feeling discomfort because they're afraid to pick up the phone, that's a little bit different than, hey, you know, I'm having a real concern with this recruiter that is not being very nice to me. Right. So, you know, but those are the little things that can actually, I think, make the difference. And it's the same way with your employees. Like, you know, I'll go back to that. It's like touch base with them, make sure that you're on top of it. And generally, you're not going to introduce anything bad by doing that. You're only going to give yourself a chance to save somebody if they're feeling a little uncomfortable. But yeah, back to, I kind of got off target a little bit, but those little things do, they mean so much to candidates. And I'm a big believer in that. And a lot of them don't even cost any money at all. And the ones that do, yep, it's a pretty minor expense.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So the other question I had, I did remember it, is if you have someone who's billing, let's say, 500K plus, and you recruit them and you get them hired at a new firm and they're going to start at that new firm, in terms of integrating with the existing team, before I ask, I'll give you an analogy. In jiu-jitsu, which I practice, there's, you know, a belt system. So you start at white belt and you get to black belt eventually. So if we have a new person come to our gym, it makes a difference if it comes in and he's a white belt, then we have a certain understanding of that person. If he's a mid-tier belt, we have a different understanding. But if he comes in and he's new and he's a black belt, then there's a little bit of, ooh, you know, this person's a black belt. And that's a different, some people are intimidated, some people are maybe inspired, et cetera, but people have more of a reaction to that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, are you saying what's the proper?
So I'm saying you're recruiting black belts, essentially. If we carry this analogy over, right? You're recruiting black belts. So if they go into a place that has, let's say, there's five other recruiters, and they're averaging 200 to 400, and then now comes this person who's billing 700, and this may be a non-issue, I don't know, but I'm just relating it to something like martial arts or other places where people have a particular reaction to someone who is at the top of the game, right? So I'm just wondering the integration of that person with the team. What is that like that you've seen? How does that typically go? Or is the culture that everybody's billing over 500K? Just what does that typically look like?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that popped into my head as you were saying, you're talking about this topic. I'll tell you this, it would be very difficult to attract a 700K biller into a team with 200 and 300K billers. I mean, typically top talent wants to be around other top talent. Now, if some of your listeners are saying, yeah, but I don't have it in-house, but I want to hire it externally. So how do I do that? How do I make that adjustment? And really the only way that I can see doing that successfully is to make sure that, you know, you are putting that person on a pedestal. They have to feel special. If you're treating them equally or less than, you know, when you're standing next to other people and you're doubling them up with your production, then it's a tough sell. So, and I get asked this a lot, you know, like what are the other producers like at the, and so I would say the majority of the time I'm placing people into an environment where they're equal, or maybe even not quite as good, but on their way up to that special mark. And so I can use that as a tool to say, I'm surrounding you with people that are better than you. And that's not an insult. That's an opportunity to learn. That's an opportunity to get mentorship. It's an opportunity to take best practices from people that are doing things at a very high level. And so, you know, it becomes a recruiting tool, if I can say that. So it would be a challenge to try and, you know, if you're running a 5-person perm shop, and the top billers at 300, you're going to have a hard time finding somebody that's going to be willing to come in there that's billing, you know, 500 plus, because it just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel. Now, if you ask them to come in and become the team leader and to then elevate everybody else's game, that's a different story. You know, that we can do, but, and then, you know what, you do run the risk of ruffling the feathers of the 200 and 300K billers. And maybe that's the tough choice that you have to make is, do I risk, you know, people that have been with me a long time that are very, you know, solid, steady Eddie, 250, 300, 350K a year billers, or do I not? And that's a, you know, I'm sure that's a question that has to be asked and answered individually depending upon the circumstances. So I don't know if that exactly answers your question, but the way I would summarize it is that I'm almost always putting similar talent into a place where, you know, their billings are reflective of their peers. And so when they're coming in, it's very much like an equal. It feels, I don't think anybody ever comes in and doesn't feel like they've been treated just because they're the new kid on the block, that they've got to earn their stripes. I mean, you know, some, obviously there's some things in there that you do, but from a just straight up worker bee standpoint, I think they're all treated pretty equally.
Okay. And I want to switch gears and skip a couple topics and skip over to some owner issues that are related to this as well. And maybe you can tell me, just curious, what are your thoughts on the model that a firm owner might use, whether it's full cycle or blended, meaning you split the desk in half or you have everybody have ownership of their own desk. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my opinion has changed a lot. I was very, you know, old school. I mean, my first 7 years were Robert Half in the mid 90s and early 2000s. And so, you know, there was a way to do this, and that was the Robert Half way, right? And that model of full desk 360, eat what you kill, you know, work a split system. If you have the candidate and I have the client, we each get half. I mean, that was sort of ingrained in my soul for about the first 18 years of my career. And then, you know, I got introduced to some different paths and patterns. And then when I did this niche for the last four and a half years, I saw just how many different models there are. And, you know, I give you, like, here's an example. I had a firm where everybody was full desk, and they hired a gentleman that was particularly gifted at bringing in the business. And so, you know, we had a conversation. I got to be a part of it with the, because I had placed that candidate there. And then the firm owner said, hey, I think we want to try and hire somebody for this person's team. You know, what do you think? Should we do full desk? Should we do? And that's when we started asking questions to the team leader and said, hey, you know, if we brought in a really good account manager and full cycle recruiter to put around you, do you think that actually is probably the best model because you're so good at the BD? And he said, yeah, I do think that would be what I'd like to try. And so, and you know, we can also look now forward because I stay in touch with that team. I mean, this duo is going to do somewhere between 2.2 and probably 2.7 million this year. And, you know, there's only one person bringing in the business. And we actually, I just got a call from one of the partners of the firm this weekend, and we're going to be looking for an additional person to come over and to try and help with that desk because they're just so successful at bringing this business. So, you know, that's a case where they had always thought about full desk, but then because the person was somebody that was going to work better in, you know, a situation where we surrounded them with really good recruiters, that's what we did. And so for them, you know, he's on a draw. But for the woman that we put on his team, we put her on a salary because that's where she came from. She came from an environment where she was delivering and doing account management, and she was on a salary. And so we basically created a customized plan where we gave her a smaller percentage, obviously, because it's a salary, a smaller percentage of the revenue for the team. And then we kept the team lead on a draw. And so, but that same company hired somebody else for a different practice and a different practice leader. And when they were ready to hire, they wanted full desk. They wanted somebody to bring in the clients and the business. So that's what I mean by flexibility and building the box around the person. This is the same firm, and this is two different practice leaders and two different people working underneath them. That's very much different. So I would say
that's interesting within the same firm, because usually it would be one or the other per firm, if that makes sense. They make a decision to go this way or that way. So it's interesting.
Well, there's a reason that firm has had success hiring people this year. I think they've hired like a half a dozen people from me this year alone. And, you know, it's because of that ability to be so nimble and get creative and think outside the box and really to do what's right for the person. If they weren't willing to do that, they would not have hired those two people. One of those two people wouldn't be there. Right. It would be, you know, probably the one that said that they wanted, you know, the account manager, full cycle recruiter. If that's what we knew going into it, then they probably wouldn't have been hired. But it just made sense that, you know, we capitalize on his strength, which happens to be business development. And he's also very good on the candidate side. But if we free him up to focus more on the business development, then he's kind of a machine and knows how to really bring in a lot of job orders. And then, of course, the woman that we put next to him is phenomenal at finding the candidates. And so they're ham and egging it really well. And we're going to try and rinse and repeat that until somebody puts their hand up and says, stop.
And what about, this is related, but you could have a rainmaker who comes over. Well, let's say there's a rainmaker who's working at a firm currently, and you're trying to recruit this person. He's a successful recruiter. And he says to you, I'm open, but I currently have three researchers who do my grunt work for me here. And my concern is I go to the new firm and I lose my little team. Is that something that comes up? Because to me, that's a big thing. If you're a top producing recruiter, you probably have a decent amount of support, whether that's researchers or admin or internal splits or something. And I would think that they would want to know what that's going to be, because what I think the ideal structure is for someone over 500K is that you sort of gift them support people as they grow, right? So you maybe say you're first, you get a part-time researcher to do your grunt work when you hit, I don't know, 400K, let's say. And then for every 200K beyond that, you get another part-time researcher. So essentially your job gets easier the better you get at it, and you get to just zero in more laser-like on those high revenue activities, and you can offset the other work to lower level people. Does that come up in recruiting someone, or have you seen that play out in different ways, you know, when someone is switching firms?
Yeah, I mean, it usually becomes about fit, right? And if you're if you're targeting a certain kind of candidate, then you know you got to have some flexibility around some of those special asks, like maybe a researcher. You know, I've definitely placed people that have brought a recruiter with them that they've worked with in the past. I work with firms that have plenty of researchers and project builders and maybe even offshore resources that can provide clean lists for top producers. So, yeah, and again, I think it really just goes back to, I keep saying it, but if you can have some flexibility to create the box around the person, it gives you the best chance to hire the best people. And that's where, if your current structure is to not utilize, you know, researchers, or maybe you just don't have that infrastructure, then you can't target that candidate. You're not setting yourself up or them up for success if they do come over. So now, I have had firms that said, look, find me the producer, and then before they start, find me a researcher or a recruiter to put around them. And so then the pressure really gets on me, because I've got to go out and find that second person so that my first person is comfortable when they start. So, you know, we've definitely done that a number of times. But yeah, I mean, I would say that for that specific question about, you know, having an internal resource next to that person to create efficiency. And I do agree with you. I think, you know, once you do get to that level, then the job becomes easier. It's the frustrating part is there's just not enough hours in the day. And if you can reduce your administrative workload, you know, you're sifting through the crappy profiles on LinkedIn to get to the good ones, you know, that kind of stuff, then, you know, then if you're only looking at clean, good profiles, then you're going to be, you know, significantly more productive. And if you're a firm owner, then that should mean overall profitability goes up, even if you're paying a few thousand dollars a month in salary to have somebody sit next to them and help them.
Agreed. So maybe let's talk a little bit about time management and how you work, how you run your desk, how you run your business. That's always something that people are curious about. And I'll just ask you kind of an open-ended question. What gets you excited about your workday? If you wake up in the morning and you're going to work and you're excited, what is it about your work that makes you excited?
Well, honestly, it's the niche that I'm in is where all of my passion and energy comes from. So when I found myself looking for a new opportunity, you know, whatever, 4.5, 5 years ago. And I think I answered an ad on LinkedIn. I don't remember, but I was definitely actively looking to make a change. And I didn't realize it at the time, but it was a rec direct firm. And I didn't even know that existed. I got to be honest. I literally had no idea that there was a recruiting firm for recruiters. And so, you know, it felt good. Like, I don't know how else to explain it. Like, for the first time in my life, I was found myself sitting on the other side of the desk, and I had somebody out there advocating for me in the marketplace. And, you know, they showed me to like 3 different places. I had 3 different offers. I mean, I was just like, wow, like this was such a good experience.
Oh, I get it. So you were recruited by a recruiter to place you at a firm. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Got it. Okay. Okay.
And that's, and then that relationship that I formed with that person that was, you know, helping me, you know, turned into, you know, a job. Like he was like, you know what? I would rather hire you internally than collect a fee. So come work for me. And I did. And because, again, it felt so good to have somebody in my corner helping me look for a job. It was just a really positive experience. And so I felt like if I could do that for my colleagues and peers, that I'm not sure I could have more fun. And look, I'm right. I mean, for me personally, I'm right, because, you know, for the last 4.5 years, I've never had more fun recruiting in my, and I've never been as successful. I mean, I'm already this year, I've already produced more than I ever have in any 12 months prior over my 20+ year career. And, you know, and I do, I wake up every day excited to help people that are just like me find great mm-hmm. new opportunities. And the other side of that is the relationships that I have with my clients are just as much advisory as it is vendor. Like I, mm-hmm. you know, I get asked all the time, like if I wanted to launch an interim division, what kind of things do I need to think about? If I wanted to launch a new practice, what do I need to do? Mm-hmm. Like I get to have some strategic conversations with farm yeah. owners. And it's just, for me, that is just, I can't think of anything more fun. It's fun. It's not work. It's fun. And yeah. so I just enjoy it because I remember how positive of an experience I had. And I try to deliver that same experience to everybody I work with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so I guess the flip side of that is what do you struggle with, or what are the things that are difficult for you to navigate?
Everybody has those things, right? So, mm-hmm. I have never in my last 4.5 years doing this, I've probably never had as many counteroffers accepted, and I would say exponentially. And you know, that's the thing, right? That we constantly tell our candidates, don't fall for the counteroffer. Don't fall for the counteroffer. You know, mm-hmm. who falls for the counteroffer more than anybody else? The recruiter that says, don't fall for the counteroffer. That too. You know, as crazy as it might sound, and again, we're talking about people with phenomenal pedigrees, but I've never been ghosted so much in my entire life. It's wow. crazy to me yeah. how many times I'll spend an hour doing an intake. I mean, dig deep, peel the onion, and then mm-hmm. and they're telling me they're excited. They're telling me they want to interview with my client, and then they're gone. Mm-hmm. They're in the ether somewhere. Not mm-hmm. they're not returning my call, that's for sure. So you know, those things are frustrating. I think the other thing too, it doesn't bother me anymore, but one of the things that I had the hardest time with in the beginning is I'm born and raised in the Midwest, so I'm a very trusting person. Like I don't typically make people have to fight too hard to get my trust. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. so I wasn't as skeptical as I needed to be. You know, recruiting recruiters mm. is challenging because they know what you want to hear. They know mm-hmm. what a good biller's numbers are. They know, you know, what, you know, they may say they make 30 calls a day. They set 10 appointments a week. They do this, they do that. Right. And so, mm-hmm. you know, they're telling you exactly what they know you want to hear to get excited to work with them. And what I've had to learn to do is to be very skeptical. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. well, not unfortunately, but I guess fortunately, I've gotten really good at being kind of sneaky skeptical. So I never mm-hmm. convey skepticism on my calls, but I am constantly trying to poke holes in the story that I'm being told. And, you know, I feel like now at this stage of the game, I'm pretty darn good at finding the pretenders and finding the real deal. So, mm-hmm. But those are the things that probably stand out the most. I mean, other than that, it's just the same stuff that you would, regardless of your vertical or industry. But you know, what's interesting is I've always felt like my greatest gift is selling, like getting mm-hmm. the business in the door. And that's not at all in my niche. I'm in such high demand that mm-hmm. I say no probably 9 times out of 10. I can't help you because mm-hmm. I'm not hearing what I need to hear to get passive talent excited. Or it's just a bandwidth thing. You know, right now the, mm-hmm. the bandwidth is such that I've got a lot of great clients that I work with. So there's only so much room for more. And I need to do what I'm telling everybody else to do, which is go hire really smart people to put around me so that I can grow my business and help more yeah. firms. So yeah. Those are the things that come to mind.
Yeah. So one thing that popped up in my head, and there may not be a good answer to this, I don't know, but while you were talking, is I've seen sometimes you can have a person who is a top producer and they, in their mind, they've done it all themselves and they've created the production themselves. But when you drill into the details of what they've done, let's say there's somebody who's billing 500K, but 90% of that is with one client, right? So when you remove that one client, and let's say they haven't had to do business development because they've had this cash cow client, subtract that and they go down to a much lower production and they really struggle because they just haven't had to do a lot of business development or to bring in new business. That's one scenario. Another scenario is maybe it's a similar thing where they've got a couple of cash cows that the owner kicked over to them when they started, like here, run with this client. So they never developed that. And it's, I guess, the same scenario where they're over-indexed on a couple of clients that provided, you know, really good production. And I said, I don't know if there's a good answer for this, but how do you sleuth that out? It used to be a little easier to figure some of these things out, but are there any things that you do to try to test or figure out where that production is coming from?
I mean, yes, especially if the firm if the firm I'm representing, I know, is sensitive to that question, then I'll certainly, you know, dig and you know, we'll ask questions. You know, what if you're a 500K biller, right, and you're working in an environment where splits happen, what percentage mm-hmm. of the 500 are you getting both sides of the deal? What percentage are you getting the other side of the deal? If mm-hmm. it's a significant number, like say 50-50, then it's like, and then are you traditionally repping the company or the candidate in that other 50%? So, you know, I do try to dig very deep on sort of how they get there. You know, one mm-hmm. of my intake questions is, what is your business development process like? So if I'm talking mm-hmm. to a full desk or a split desk salesperson, like, you know, I always say, hey, don't have to give me the secret sauce here, but like, you know, what do? How do you find business? And I mm-hmm. try to collect that information and pass that along. As far as the question about having, you know, a couple of significant clients, you know, I think back to my best year at Robert Half. This is, again, a long time ago in the 90s. But I worked with three big firms that each represented over $150,000 in revenue for that particular year. And then I had plenty of onesie twosies, you know, every month or every other month with other firms mm-hmm. That I maybe only made one or two or three placements over the course of the year. But when you added it all up, it was a very successful year in mm-hmm. recruiting. And so, you know, I guess it's just, you have to handle it on a case by case basis. And I think too, it's not hard when you have somebody that's experienced that kind of success and they're willing to consider making a change. I think it's as much a question for the candidate as it is for the client. Like, hey, you're not going to have, you know, ABC that's going to give you $250,000 in fees anymore like you had at your last firm. Like, how are you going to make up for that? Like, are you going to mm-hmm. look for another ABC? Are you going to split your time more evenly amongst a larger pool of clients? And really kind of talk about a campaign or a go-to-market, you know, structure so that everybody's being honest, because I think most of the time candidates don't want to put themselves in a situation to fail either. You mm-hmm. know, they want to be able to know that they're going to come in and be supported and be able to have success. And that means a lot of times for the first year, stepping away from your current client base and going out and building some new relationships. So I think as much as anything, it's a question to the candidate, like, how confident are you knowing that you're going to be giving up, you know, one or two clients that represented such a large percentage of your mm-hmm. revenue? And if their answer is not where it needs to be, then it's probably not the right fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that brought up my final question for you, which I'm just curious, what is the biggest reason for leaving that you hear from recruiters?
Oh, it is almost different every time. Wow. I can tell you there are some firms that continue to make, I say mistakes, but they're making choices that don't feel mm-hmm. good to a lot of their people. So, you know, I see this happen a lot where a firm takes a private equity investment. And so it's usually not a change in the first year, but maybe as you get into year two and three and that PE firm starts directing initiatives mm-hmm. and how we're going to grow and who we're going to support and scale a team around and in what structure that's going to look like. And they start really changing the things around enough that the senior people tend to get a little like, you know what, I don't feel like this is where I want to be anymore, right? And mm-hmm. sometimes I'm thinking about some of my more recent intakes and placements. You know, sometimes you'll find somebody that started with a firm 7, 8, 9 years ago, and they were very small and they were very entrepreneurial feeling. And now they're, you know, 150 people. And mm-hmm. and for them, it just doesn't feel like the right fit anymore. You know, mm-hmm. there's firms out there that are very youthful and people eventually grow up and they get married and they have kids. And then being in that youthful environment isn't feeling as good as it once did. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it's just bad leadership. Very rarely do I hear from people that it's just all about the money. Money is a factor. Mm-hmm. It always is. I mean, most of us are in this business to make good money, but I don't usually have that be the first thing that comes out of somebody's mouth. Sometimes it is, but most mm-hmm. of the time it's something else. And so, but that something else could be a myriad of different things. It could be a lack of tools. It could be the inability to scale. You know, a lot of companies will have somebody that's been with them a long time and they're doing really well. And then they hire a bunch of fresh grads basically to come in. And then mm-hmm. they ask that person to, you know, be a mentor and let them see how you do things and answer their questions, but they're not necessarily compensated for it. But mm-hmm. then it becomes an energy suck and a change in culture as you insert a lot of younger people around some seasoned vets. So, you know, mm-hmm. there, man, I could go on for days on that question.
Yeah. Okay.
And but I'll tell you, some of the firms, like there's one firm in particular that I've had particular success pulling people out of. And they've really just continued to mismanage the COVID. I mean, they've done things to make a lot of people there very uncomfortable. And and so, yeah, I mean, and then word started to get around that I was having success helping some of these people that had been there for 8, 10, and 15 years. And now they're just referring me like crazy because everybody's complaining and about the same thing. And say, call Magruder the recruiter. He'll take care of you.
Yeah, that's convenient. Your name rhymes with recruiter. Magruder the recruiter. Easy to remember.
That's right.
Well, listen, let me this is excellent, John. And I'm going to do a recap here for people listening so they can hear what notes I've taken and take their own notes as well. So first thing we talked about were some of the mistakes that owners make when hiring recruiters. And the biggest one, which is, I guess, surprising and not surprising, was the dragging your feet. Right, the timeliness issue of not moving the process quick enough. The same thing that you and your business probably experience with your own niche is also the same as what most owners do in the recruiting industry, it sounds like. So that was one, speeding up the interview process. Number two was to be flexible about how to attract the right person so that you're not just trying to fit them into what you already have, but you're being creative within reason to be able to build something, or as John said, build the box around the person. And some of those things might include flexible hours, working virtually, some discretion on the KPIs and how those are reported and what needs to be collected, that sort of thing. One thing that John mentioned that you can do creatively with the how you're going to pay someone is to charge a lower commission on the first 100K if you need to recover some of the salary. Let's say if you negotiate to give them a higher salary, you could have a lower commission on the first 100K or the first 200K for that matter, that helps you to recoup some of that investment and that risk. We talked a little bit about draw versus salary, and John said that for retained searches, they're usually salary. For contingency or hybrid shops, they're often draw. And then for the staffing split desk model, they're usually salary as well. And he mentioned one scenario, the highest draw that he's heard of, or me, which is 250K draw for someone who is producing $1 million. A couple other scenarios would be a 7K draw for 6 months that then drops down to a lower draw, maybe a 3 or 5K draw after that point. Another example is it's a draw for the first 90 days, then it converts to a salary. I think I got that the other way around. It's a salary for the first 90 days, then converts to a draw if you're wanting to have a draw. And that would be to offset the fact that they're not going to bill, most likely they're not going to hit the ground running, right? The other possibility would be a guaranteed base salary with a lower percent, or I think I already mentioned that one. Commissions with a straight draw, what John has seen is 40% is the minimum, and then typically up to 50% once in a while, higher than that, but probably for very high levels of production. Almost all of his placements are now virtual. The onboarding is remote as well, which makes it difficult or more, it's going to require extra steps and extra thoughtfulness. One thing he mentioned is make sure to have a very short start date. No surprise there, preferably a couple of weeks, and to keep them warm during that interim process before they start. And we gave some examples of you could send them flowers, you could send them some company swag, baseball hats, anything to make them feel like they're a part of the team as soon as possible. He did mention 75% of the time they are not meeting in person before they hire someone, which is interesting. And that's, again, another COVID trend. In terms of recruiting, you know, top people, generally they're going to a culture where that level of production is the standard. There could be exceptions, of course, but generally they're going to expect to go to a place where other people would be at a peer level. We talked a little bit about split desk versus full desk. Firms are doing it differently, and some firms even have the different models within their company. And that goes back to building it around the person as well. And there's pluses and minuses to that. I can see some pluses and minuses, but being creative to get the right person is required. We talked a little bit about what John loves and what motivates him. And he said, really, it's his passion for the niche. Recruiting recruiters feels like fun to him. And that's something, if you can get to that with whatever niche you're in, where you're enjoying it, and that's a good reason to consider your level of passion for a particular industry versus another, if you're in a place where you're thinking about switching your niche. I do think that having a passion for it makes a big difference. Just makes it more fun and more easy to succeed. What else? We talked about struggles and counter offers are happening more. Again, no surprise there. More clients ghosting than before. Again, that's a pattern that has increased. And a couple of key questions that John will ask for a person to kind of sniff out their how they've gotten to their production. One of the questions he uses is, what is your business development process like? Which I like as an open-ended question, just to see what they come up with. What is your business development process like? Another one you might ask to test for client diversification would be, how many clients have you invoiced over the last year? Right? How many clients have you invoiced over the last 12 months? And we talked about reason for leaving. There's sounds like many, many different reasons, but what he mentioned was a lack of tools, unable to scale, having to be a mentor when you don't want to be, the energy drain of that. But it sounds like there's a lot of different reasons that someone might leave. And that's where we got to. So John, thank you again for sharing your information and your wisdom. I really appreciate you taking the time to do that for us.
Yeah, you bet. I enjoyed it very much. Thanks for having me.
You bet. You bet. And for those listening, I hope you enjoyed this. You can send me your feedback to gary@therecruitinglab.com. You can contact John at r2rsearch.com. That's r2rsearch.com. And otherwise, I will be back with you next month, same time, same place, with another audio interview. Have a great month, and I'll talk to you then. Bye-bye.